Welcome back to Sphere. You're listening to the local voice of our hemisphere. We are here on WMBR Cambridge, and you're more than welcome to call us at 617-253-8810. Amy and I were just talking during the break how positive this movement seems, although, you know, there's a lot of killings involved and there's a lot of violence in it, and we are very saddened by that. But at the same time, if you remember, you know, back in the day when the indigenous people are protesting for something like this, it'll never be on the cover of New York Times or BBC or, you know, any popular news media. But now it is. And a lot more people are paying attention to it. So that sort of gets me hopeful and excited. Just learning that more people are out there to care. And, as the movement is being escalated, you know, maybe something will happen, and maybe for once, the people will be heard.
Yeah, I think that's a hopeful note for us to end on here. And, you know, we welcome your comments and questions and suggestions. Give us email about this. We'd love to know what you think. Our email address is sferio@wmbr.org. Siempre estamos interesados en saber qué opinan de lo que programamos aquí. Pueden mandarnos correo electrónico a sferio, sferio, @wmbr.org. Bueno, se nos acaba el tiempo. No tenemos tiempo otra vez para los anuncios, pero si están por Cambridge y quieren ir mañana al Festival del Río, empieza mañana a las 12 de la tarde, creo yo. Y pueden encontrar información acerca de eso en el internet en cambridgema.gov. If you are in the Cambridge area, we have time for this one little announcement. Tomorrow is the Cambridge River Festival. There will be music and dancing and all kinds of fun stuff from all over the many cultures represented here in this part of Massachusetts. You can find out more about it on the internet at cambridgema.gov. I think that's it, my dear. We'll see you next week.
Next week. Adios.
Ciao.
Yes, yes. Marhaban. Welcome all. And all are welcome here on Music for Humans. I am Dr. Jalas Sakran, and once again I welcome you. Time certainly appears to be passing here. I notice that we rarely really take a long view of time. It's rare for someone, for instance, to think when he's experiencing a birthday, there I am, 1 year closer. No, we always think 1 year further away from our birth, as though you are meant to live forever. Now, I know that it seems natural to think of things that way, but another example is that a person, when he paints his walls, will rarely think, my house is getting smaller. Because, of course, it is one molecule smaller every time. How many people take that layer of paint off before they put another one on? It is strange. Well, I would like to welcome back on the program Professor Levine, Jewish mystic professor. Professor, welcome.
And as always, it's my deep pleasure to be with you all.
Thank you, Professor. We also have with us Ivan the Mellow.
Товарищ, добрый вечер.
Marhaban, Ivan. Ivan is Siberian. And as Ivan will tell you if you ask him, being Siberian is enough.
It's more than enough, actually.
We're also pleased to welcome, for the first time, Roberta Sharp. Roberta, welcome.
Hi.
Roberta is a scientist with no particularly well-defined specialty, is that right?
No, that's not true.
Also, I was misinformed. Mm-hmm. Well, the staff will be punished.
As they should be.
So what exactly is your specialty?
Well, I focus on hermaphrodite worm mating behavior.
Well, that's a very specific specialty.
Yes, I find it very intriguing.
And I suppose there must be a lot of lessons really to be learned from the mating of hermaphroditic worms.
Well, they often self-mate, and so you learn about the self and the importance of the inner being.
The auto-mating teaches these lessons about the self.
We call it self-mating.
Self-mating.
Yes.
Now, Roberta, was that your name?
Roberta, yes.
I've heard it said that in our own evolutionary past as humans, and maybe you could confirm or correct this, that humans all used to be hermaphrodites who would self-mate, and that it was only a very late evolutionary mutation which led to gender differentiation and sexual coupling.
I do not know if that is necessarily true, because there is even gender in yeast, and so I feel that it is unlikely that humans arose from hermaphroditic behavior.
Because I've heard it said that in fact sexual differentiation only occurred among humans in the past 100 or 200 years.
Well, people don't necessarily assign the greatest scientific value to Jewish mysticism.
Well, go, 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 said the bird. And really, humankind, I think, is not prepared for this reality.
So, Roberto, how do you go about identifying a population of hermaphroditic worms?
So they've actually been isolated. They originally isolated. So we study a specific strain of hermaphroditic worms called C. elegans. They're called as such because they're extremely elegant in their movement. And they were isolated over 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Well, as our listeners know, the show is not really about us. It's about really taking the opportunity to connect with you. So if you'd like to call and join in our discussion, the number is 617-253-8810. Caller, you are on the air.
Hello.
Welcome, caller.
Hey, this is Tom Cruise.
Yes, welcome, Tom.
Thank you. I just wanted to say I'm really excited by this discovery of these worms. I think it really shows that, you know, life, you know, at a basic level is really meant to be gay and is really meant to reach out and touch those who are most like it. And these worms having all the stuff that they need to have fun are just one example in a plethora of examples.
Well, yeah, I'm not sure that you understand the mechanics of the mating here, Tom.
Yeah, they just stick their own things into their own things, right?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure it could be regarded as homosexual because there really is only one gender. Is that right, Roberta?
It's actually not true. There are two genders. There are males and hermaphrodites. And a hermaphrodite will prefer...
That sounds pretty gay to me. Just a bunch of, you know, hoo-hoo dillies.
I'm not sure what a hoo-hoo dilly is exactly.
Donkers? Just a bunch of donkers.
Well, in my view, it's more an issue of self-sufficiency. And we have this ideal of the human, the male, the cowboy, who can be self-sufficient alone on the range.
Yeah, Brokeback Mountain.
Brokeback Mountain. But Brokeback Mountain is not a true case of self-sufficiency. A true... A self-sufficient human would only require themselves for mating.
Yeah, well, they're amateurs. Let me put it that way.
Of course, Tom Cruise knows all about this because he's a prototype of self-sufficiency, and I just want to cut in and say that I'm a really big fan of yours.
Oh, right back at you. Show me the money. That wasn't my line, but favorite of mine.
Yeah, I'm not sure that really the self-sufficiency argument carries over into, you know, mating behavior.
There's actually a beautiful lesson to be learned about the continuity of life from worm behavior. There's a worm mutant that I study called Bag of Worms that is incapable of laying its own eggs, and so the eggs hatch from within the worm and the baby worms eat their way out of the mother. It's a beautiful lesson.
I wouldn't want to do that.
You wouldn't want to?
I wouldn't want to give birth to a worm through my own body and have it eat me.
Well, if you were a worm, I think you might feel differently.
I wonder if it hurts.
I'm sure it does.
It ultimately results in the death of the mother worm.
But it is this beautiful picture and idea of life, the cycle of life. The moment it ends, it begins anew, and the body of the mother actually contributes to the health and the nutrition of the young in a very beautiful way, I think.
Katie Holmes is shaking her head. She thinks that's disgusting.
But I'm sure that Mrs. Holmes would assert that if it came to...
She doesn't assert much. She's pretty much... She's laid back. She's actually reading Dianetics right now to our child, Applebee's.
Well, this idea of the mutant worm reminds me of a very beautiful saying from Jewish thought, which says, "You shall always remember from whence you came and to whence you are going. From whence you came, from a drop of sperm, and to where you are going, to the stomach of worms." This reminds, if you have this picture in front of you at all times, of your source and your final destination, it will keep you humble.
Well, I heard that the odds are that you'll actually end up as part of pretty much everything. There are so many molecules in your body, so right now you're probably, some of your saliva has been part of, Charles Darwin's butt.
And it's interesting, really, to consider the idea of one spreading out like that and dissolving, and maybe really that's what death is. But to me, it brings me back to this idea that really we're all part of this system and we're all going to exist forever, but perhaps not in the same form. And I think it must be really wonderful to rejoin a greater circle in this way, which is why I'm shocked here that so many people like to enter an impregnable box after their death. It seems like really a terrifying thing to me.
And some people like it within their life also.
To remain boxed.
Yes. I've heard it has a calming effect on hysterics.
To be in a box?
Yes, to be in a very confined space.
Do you sell those?
Well, there are coffin makers who will sell you a very, very nice box.
I mean, I personally am against
the inside?
Any commercial enterprise, but yes, I believe some coffin makers will sell coffins for the living.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are flotation tanks. Have you guys ever been in one of those?
A flotation tank, you mean like a boat?
No, it's like a, it's like a boat.
A boat. Yeah, I've never been on a boat.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, when you get inside one of them, you can really, it's all dark, and you're just floating in water, and you really just start trancing out and meditating pretty deeply.
It's just like waterboarding?
Yeah, it's like worms.
Is it?
Yeah. It's like being a worm, because they're just swimming along all day, and they're just thinking about what it's like to be a worm. And that's what I do. I just think about what it's like to be a worm. And
I think that can have a very strong calming effect also, just imagining oneself burrowing and burrowing and burrowing.
Eating dirt.
Deeply into the earth and becoming part of the earth and one with the earth.
They don't go that far. They stop at some point and then come back up. It's like a up and down, it's like a Ferris wheel.
Aperta, please.
I would like to return to the lessons that can be learned from the bag of worms phenotype, because
is it called a bag of worms?
A bag of worms.
Like a bag?
It's
you carry around full
it's,
of worms.
It's no, the bag is the mother and inside are the baby worms.
It's pretty cute.
It is. But it also seems a little gruesome. But we have to consider the fact that we are also feeding off our own mothers, or we did at one point. And that should help us.
I still am.
You're still feeding off your mother?
A little bit. It's a Scientology thing. I don't really want to get into it because the press always spins these things. But yes. Every Sunday night.
Well, I think it's, in some ways it's healthy to have, at least to have a good, strong relationship with one's mother. I'm not sure precisely what you are insinuating
but it
there.
It is true that adult males do not get enough calcium. So, if there was...
Well, I'm not sure about that.
Cow's milk is really quite cruel and,
Well, and I think, again... I think if we all were to take the long view, we would see that it's not a sustainable system. The idea that that I might, until the end of time, be able to drink cow's milk seems somewhat ridiculous. But, Roberta, isn't there an issue...
Well, are you going to are you going to be around at the end of time? What, you know?
Well, you know, again,
I don't plan on that.
See, it's strange, but people, they alternate between this view that they're going to die immediately, and therefore they can just ruin the world around them, and the view that they will live forever, and that that they don't need to. So, you know, for instance, you might feel that it's not necessary to work tonight because you are probably going to be alive tomorrow. And at the same time, you might feel that it's acceptable to cut down the tree in front of your house because maybe you feel like you won't be around tomorrow to want the shade from the tree. So it's this alternating view of convenience.
Yeah, you're just thirsty for that sap, so that liquid.
What I try to do is to change my behavior regularly, like day by day. One day I will behave as though I'm going to live forever, so I won't paint my house because I want it to stay the same size. And the next day, I will behave as though I'm about to die. So
then you paint your house.
Yeah, and I spend all of my money doing it because
I do it every other day.
Probably won't need it the next day.
Yeah.
Well, there's an interesting saying in the Jewish tradition which says that you should treat every day as if it may be your last, so that you shouldn't let a single day go by without valuing it and living within the vibrating circle of life. And
I think that's a Kim Jong-il, North Korean proverb. Just, you know, doesn't really matter, but...
And another saying which I like is that you should always view the world as being perfectly balanced between good and evil, so that any single good act that you commit will bring positive karma to the world, and any single, even minor, bad act will bring negative karma and tip the balance.
It doesn't really make sense, though, because if the world's completely balanced, and if you do something good, then there's something bad's going to happen to balance it out, right? Isn't that what that means?
Well, I think it's an individual balance.
Well, there are these two.
So if you do something good, then something bad's going to happen.
No, you put good out, so good has to come back in.
Well,
there might not be a balance. There could be a runaway good effect if enough people have good karma, right?
Mm. Well, there are probably two main views in religion about the balance between good and evil. In one view, good and evil are essentially two sides to the same coin, and they must always be balanced, and any sort of imbalance will ultimately right itself. This is probably more in line with the New Age view. But there
kind of
is
a Taoist thing.
Yeah, like a Taoist thing. But there is this other line of thought which is more in line with probably traditional Judeo-Christian religions, which views the world in a struggle between good and evil, in which ultimately good will prevail.
Mm-hmm. And then there's, you know, there's like transhumanism, which is, you know, you just got to keep moving forward, keep moving up, keep bettering things for yourself and everyone else. And it's not really a religious thing at all. It's just, you know, we can create good for us if we want to, and let's do it.
Yeah. That's... So transhumanism?
Yeah, it's like an idea. I probably, you know, obviously this isn't the real Tom Cruise because I wouldn't be able to do that because my transhumanist friends would, you know, they wouldn't want me to come out as a... Oh, my Scientologist friends wouldn't want me to come out as a transhumanist, but anyway.
Now, transhumanism, does it have anything to do with transgendered worms?
Unfortunately not, no. It's actually about, it's about bettering the human race, like it's about eliminating poverty, and mainly it's about making people... it's like a kind of a modern Buddhism thing with technology involved. So it's like, let's alleviate suffering through technology, through...
And I think that's a really good point there. This combination of you know, using technology but with a caring spirit.
Right.
And I really...
You don't want to live in a cold Terminator world.
No,
and you want to have intelligence.
I really, really like to hear... about that, like the attitude of the scientist with a spiritual eye for
right.
things.
Or even not even, you know, I mean, spiritual is, means a lot of things, but I'm a scientist, and I just think I'd like to make life better for my kids.
It's funny that in most of the prevailing fiction and movies about our future and the role technology will play mostly paints a very bleak picture.
Mm-hmm. And that's good. I think that's good because it makes people aware of the problems that there are in technology. And it makes the people who are working on the stuff very aware of it, which I think is very good.
Science has greatly benefits humans as well. We've mm-hmm. learned from the worms, for instance, that we've generated these longer living worm mutants, and we've found that dietary restriction, so eating less than we do today, actually extends the lifespan of the worm, and we've moved on to translating that to mice, so we can extend the life of laboratory mice by feeding them less than we ordinarily would.
Yeah.
And so that helps us develop a balance in the world. If we consume less,
that's an Andrew Weil thing too, I think. Yeah.
Then we can extend our lifespans.
Well, have you guys heard of Ray Kurzweil?
I'm actually a neo-Luddite by choice as a Siberian.
Cool.
So I do not subscribe to these transhumanist aspirations.
Yeah. So what do you think?
I think we need to live in harmony with nature.
Yeah. Well, could we? I mean, that's why I think transhumanism is so cool, because the idea is we move into harmony with nature by, you know, using technology to satisfy our needs instead of using the earth.
Science is the most natural thing. Asking questions about the world is the most natural thing.
No, I definitely agree with that, Roberta, but my concern here would be that sometimes it's very easy for one to take a short-sighted view of the effect that science will have. For instance, you bring up this point that through severe caloric restriction one may prolong one's lifespan, and I'm not sure that this
is not that severe either. It's, you know, reducing yourself by, you know, maybe a quarter of your calories a day, depending on
is
your
that
diet.
Right, or is it more like 50%?
No, it's definitely a quarter or less if you're unless you're a complete fatty.
All right, so
actually, I would, at least in the mouse studies, beg to differ, because at least in mice, to successfully extend lifespan, we have to reduce their caloric intake to such a point that they can no longer reproduce.
Well, let's throw out the call-in number again.
Oh, that's completely different.
So the number, if anyone would like to call in, is 617-253-8810, and our operator will be glad to patch you through. Caller, welcome to the air. All right. In any case, back to my point. All I was about to say was that the caloric restriction will prolong your lifespan, and you will consume less food, but probably more overall, over the whole course of your life. You will live longer
right.
and therefore eat more. And can
well,
you imagine?
Actually, I mean, maybe not, because you only live a couple of years longer, depending on what you're subscribing
to.
So
according to my understanding, you can prolong your lifespan by as much as 50%, if that's... Is that wrong?
So, to 135? I don't know.
Sure. So, over the course of your lifespan, you will consume more resources. And can you imagine the strain that this will have on the planet, on the ecosystem?
And of course, it's a miserable existence, being hungry all the time.
Yeah, precisely. So I really appreciate Ivan's view here, which is, if I may extend it, that would you not rather have a short life full of chocolate dumplings than have a long lifespan with the agony of never having chocolate dumplings?
You could have chocolate dumplings if you want to.
Yeah, once every decade.
Well, this reminds me of this competing view, which poses the idea that the original sin of mankind was not eating from some tree, but was rather planting the first seeds of agriculture. So as soon as we left our natural state of hunting and gathering and began organized technology, then we became parasites rather than natural creatures on this earth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I don't think, I mean, there are a lot of animals that farm. And it was actually kind of a slow move that we had. We started out by plucking out certain weeds from the area that we were in as hunter-gatherers and encouraging things to grow. We'd even plant stuff as nomadic hunter-gatherers in places that we'd come back to. And so the agriculture was kind of a very slow thing. But there are ants that grow fungus in their tunnels, and they eat that fungus. And there are monkeys that do the same thing that we used to do. They pluck out stuff that's harmful to their environment. So, you know, it's kind of a fluid thing, agriculture. It kind of arises naturally from the system that we have here on Earth.
Well, caller, we do have another call, so let's try to add that into the circle and see if it's another offender. Caller, welcome.
Yes, who asked?
And there he goes again. Yeah, so I just like our callers to know that, we have FCC regulations against any exciting vocabulary.
I like to add him on Facebook.
Yes, we have to stay relaxed and calm, and that's really what the show is all about anyway. It's promoting this relaxed atmosphere and attitude about our lives and understanding our lives in a calm way and having inner peace and connections with each other and with the world.
But you also gotta do what you gotta do. You gotta jump up and solve all the world's issues even while you're sitting on your couch smoking a cheap.
One of the beautiful things about the worms that I study is that they're actually transparent to the eye, so I can see everything inside the worm. Wouldn't it be amazing if people were transparent too in their thoughts?
It'd be kind of gross. Oh, in their thoughts?
Yes.
Yeah, I think that
weird that, people out there.
That might be why worms don't have eyes.
Yeah. Because then it would just be too easy, like, who took the cookie? Okay, I see it. It's right there. Jim, you're out.
Well, I wonder what would actually occur if we could all read each other's thoughts transparently. Would this lead to a greater amount of human strife, or would it lead to an increase in our mutual understanding and love?
It would probably lead to some crazy shit. I mean, crazy poop. So
I don't know. I believe that increased transparency would improve a lot of things, especially politically.
As in wars ceasing and beating of swords into plows and lions or tigers lying with lambs.
I don't think, no.
You're
think
not sufficiently transparent in your thoughts, Dr. Levine.
That's often been said to me. And it's a criticism that I do take to heart.
That's good.
Well, the operator is waving that we have another caller. Let's hope it's a little better this time. Caller 2, welcome.
Good evening.
Welcome, caller.
I'm glad that there's continued discussion about food and consumption. Appreciate the continued theme.
Yes, thank you, caller. And obviously, its parallels should be considered.
Caller, what do you think about transparency?
Yeah, I think transparency, in all seriousness, I think the key to an ecosystem's proper functioning, whether it be a human organizational system or a non-human organizational system, would be transparency. I do like the metaphor. You can kind of take a look at the oceans. The oceans function very well with this sort of transparency, the transparency of the water, the transparency of certain fish,
Jellyfish.
Jellyfish. Very transparent fish. Very transparent.
One of the most transparent.
Well, I wonder because, of course, as humans, we developed, we evolved, we were created with the ability to tell the truth and the ability to deceive. And I wonder if this ability to deceive plays some important role sometimes in our ability to get along with each other.
I really like that view there, Professor. You know, biblically, if I recall correctly, the original development of the variety of languages, which I correlate with this idea of opacity, if you'd like, was originally to prevent humanity from cooperating. And then later, we had the invention of the shibboleth, which allowed one person to identify whether another person was from a certain tribe or not. And I really see there's a parallel there. So it's hard to see beforehand what the effect of having this transparency can be. It might, on the one hand, enable us to avoid war and strife by creating a very homogeneous understanding, but it might also cause more and bloodier wars, and it's really tough to say what the outcome would be there.
So you're saying the language barrier and, in general, human opacity and deception might be a crucial ingredient in our ability to live together.
Yeah, precisely. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to possess the same land. It's really just another sort of technology. You know, whenever any technology was invented throughout history, sooner or later, it came to be used in a violent way, even if the initial invention was benign.
So, you know, there was a discussion earlier about certain aspects of our behavior being sort of cancerous or
yes, parasitic.
Parasitic, exactly. And I think many could argue that technology itself and what defines humans is essentially, just like you said, it is sort of a parasitic, what the other caller said, is sort of parasitic nature, and that what we are sort of essentially exhibiting is, in the very short term, seems like a blessing. It seems like an advance. It seems like we are the fittest on the planet. But, of course, we are but a blip in the cosmic time scope. And so I would posit that this is essentially a cancer. Is this the outlier? We are the outlying animal in the entire animal kingdom. I'm aware of the tools that are used in the animal world, but there's a lot of transparency there. I mean, just think about technology and intellectual property. I mean, the whole premises of intellectual property or the requirements of having intellectual property is to opaquely shield it from others and only let a certain percentage of it be transparent.
Well, this thought reminds me of a dream I had several nights ago. This idea that humans are the outlier. In this dream, I was hurtling through space. I was watching the deep blackness of space and the stars stream by and the planets stream by. And at first, I was very confused. I didn't know what kind of being I was or why I was hurtling through space. And then I looked back on myself and I saw this glowing amber and I realized that I was a comet.
A glowing amber or a glowing ember?
A glowing amber, a sort of glowing comet look. And I realized that I was actually in this dream. I was no longer a human, but it was rather a comet hurtling through space. And I think it's actually a much more natural way of being to be a comet than to be a human.
Because the vision of your life then, I imagine, would be as a straight line through space instead of as a circle, really.
Or as a beautiful arc and just hurtling and hurtling through the void. And I think it was a very soothing idea. And I think it may very well be that in a past existence of mine, I was actually a comet.
But I find comets to be very scary. Because when I imagine a comet, I imagine them hurtling onto Earth and resulting in destruction.
Well, that's the scientific way of looking at things, and I think that's limiting.
Well, I'm not sure if I agree with that. I think there's just a dual view to all things. There is, in Hinduistic terms, there would be the Shiva view, and then there's the Krishna view, right? And there's always these polar things, these two opposing forces of creation and destruction. And I think one of the lessons of the modern age is that these forces, which are seemingly separate, are actually from a single force.
So you're saying that the comet hurtling towards the planet is actually the same force as the planet which is about to be destroyed.
But isn't a comet in and of itself creation and destruction? It is, as it's being created, destroying.
And massing up into its,
in the
into
fiery,
its bulk. Yes. It's like the worm.
The paradoxical sort of example of the comet, both proverbially and literally, I mean, the comet is literally ice. But we perceive it as hot. We perceive it as this fire in the sky.
Precisely. And very ancient cultures regarded the comets and other sort of fiery shooting cosmological phenomena as being some sort of Ouroboros that had lost one end of itself and therefore was hurtling through space, consuming the ether and excreting fire.
You know, what's interesting about that is that, the outer space to many on the Earth looks very much like a deep purple hue. And that, for me, sort of conjures up smoke on the water and fire in the sky. So we look at, we've just been talking about fire in the sky. Sky is can be considered deep purple, and then the smoke on the water, I think, could we segue into a smoke on the water discussion?
Yeah, of course.
I would actually like to segue back into the parasitic behavior of humans, because as the group feels that parasitic behavior of humans results in destruction, I would argue that you are also creating food for people and not necessarily destroying the land. And so in that creation, where some people might view it as destruction, many would view it as creation.
And I can really appreciate that view. I think many of our listeners are aware of some of the theories that were propagated earlier on the show, in particular theories regarding plastic and the possibility of something so durable from a biological degradation point of view. And one of the theories that was floated that really struck me as compelling was that some natural force, this force of creation and destruction, created us possibly in order to create plastic, so that plastic would then be incorporated into its new paradigm of creation and destruction, a new paradigm of life.
Well, I would continue this paradigm of creation and destruction and consider that if we do not create food, thereby destroying the land, we destroy people. So if we fail to destroy, we destroy.
And of course,
and in creating, we create.
We also create living environments for many creatures, such as pigeons and rats and squirrels and possums.
Well, and what's interesting about that is that you were talking about creation, destruction. You've got a Judeo-Christian sort of creation concept that many people in the scientific community will reject lock, stock, and barrel.
Yeah, and
it seems as this program would embrace some of the creationism lore.
Well, I would like to come back to the bag of worms, because this is also a case of creation and destruction. the creation of the baby worms can only happen with the destruction of the mother.
And I think I'd like to point out also that from a biological, like a biomass perspective, the most successful organism, the most successful species on the planet would be bacteria, I believe.
Well, many scientists believe that insects are actually the most successful organism, not necessarily from the biomass perspective, but really from the perspective that they do consume many of the world's calories.
Well, that's very interesting. I mean, another perspective might be that the crocodile is most biologically successful as a creature that has not evolved in millions of years. It has somehow reached the pinnacle of its own evolution, a local maximum.
Well, many biologists study sharks because they have an amazing immune system and they do not get cancer. And they haven't evolved in millions of years.
I really think that if vampires existed, they would be worthy of some serious study.
Well, going back to this idea of rating species by caloric intake, I wonder how this ties into this, you know, the latest dieting fads of the past two decades. I wonder if all humans went on a diet, would we lose our ranking among the species?
I think it's already pretty low. I mean, compared to bacteria, which sit inside us and even consume much of what we consume in our own process of digestion, it seems like there's really no way we can win.
But it's interesting how Dr. Levine ascribes calorie intake to superiority. Maybe it is why Americans are so powerful and exhibit such overwhelming moral superiority because of large calorie intake. So we should not really take for granted these diets that are really the abode of the inferior nations.
Yeah, why should we join them? And it's ironic that in much of the developing world, one goal that people might have is to consume as much as possible because they are hungry, whereas here it is to consume less because we're really full of everything. We've eaten a lot and we are really only at the moment trying to recover our emptiness.
And of course, after we do recover our emptiness, we would like to reclaim back our fullness.
So again, we have a cycle of creation and destruction, really ultimately tying back together into a single force.
Now, of course, there is this other philosophical view that creation, destruction, and indeed all change are mere illusions of one unchanging single entity of the universe. And this, I think, is a deeper way of looking at things. And although it may appear that there is destruction and creation, in reality, even science confirms this with the law of conservation of energy and matter, that there's really just one single entity, one single thing that we're all a part of.
Of course, it is known as chi.
Well, scientifically, I would agree with this thought process, because molecularly, we establish some sort of conservation. Even though it begins as an apple and ends as gas, those are still the same molecules.
And this idea of rearrangement also is very inspiring, because then we immediately see that in destruction we are creating, and in creation we are also destructing, because really it's all about the current arrangement. And this idea extends into a view of time. Time passing is really simply the destruction of history and its creation simultaneously.
So really, at the end of the day, we are doing nothing.
Well, we seem to be creating different things.
Well, our creation of forms such as plastic may be viewed as a kind of pulling away this veil of illusion of creation and destruction by actually making the perceived reality more in line with the true reality of a single...
But if we take an average over all time, we've done nothing.
Well, yeah, and that's also an interesting view because, you know, in our modern day, it may be difficult to realize that for much of history, one of the great challenges that we faced was simply measuring time. And time really is a master. I mean, really, time stretched out will do a lot of things, and it's very difficult for us to overcome it. And in some ways, we are now at least somewhat happily able to accurately measure time under very, very a wide range of conditions. But still, time will destroy everything, including our program. And sort of this is my warning that we are reaching the end of the hour.
Well, some gurus believe that the wristwatch is the greatest invention in the history of mankind, whereas other gurus refuse to wear a wristwatch because they believe it binds them further into this illusion of change.
Wristwatch is really just another manifestation of this destruction and creation.
Well, I personally believe that the wristwatch is such a great human invention that I wear one on each wrist.
I now use a cell phone to look for time.
So you have replaced ultimately the wristwatch with a sign of even further invention.
I destroyed my wristwatch and created a cell phone.
And I destroyed an electric typewriter and then proceeded to make a career in computers.
So it's interesting. Perhaps we should also study this new discipline emerging from the ashes, the discipline of dialogy instead of biology, because we also need to study destruction as much as we need to study life and procreation.
Before the program adjourns, I just wanted to say that I have the most utmost respect and the highest of disdain for this paradoxical theme of today's program. And I look very much forward to not listening next week.
Well, thank you so much, caller, and also no thank you. Ma salama, callers. Well, yes, once again, we seem to have consumed the hour and in so doing produced another episode of Music for Humans. I'd like to thank all of my guests. Thanks to our new guest, Roberta.
Thank you.
And thanks to our returning guests, Ivan the Mello.
Спасибо, до свидания.
And to Professor Levine.
It was my pleasure.
I am Dr. Jalis Sakran here on Music for Humans. We are on every Friday at 7 p.m. here on WMBR 88.1 FM in Cambridge. Stay tuned for Hidden Gems in Plain Sight. Ma'a salama.
for safety.
Number one.
Cars and bikes stop at red lights.
It's against the law for car drivers or bicycle riders to ignore traffic signals.
So don't buzz through red lights. There might be a pedestrian or turning car that doesn't see you coming.
Number two.
Look first before you open your door.
Numerous bicyclists have been injured or even killed by car doors suddenly opening into them.
Look first, and bicyclists, stay out of the door zone.
Number three.
Cross with the signal.
You are safest if you wait for a walk or green traffic signal.
Don't jaywalk. That's just walking into trouble.
Number four.
Cars and bikes should stop for pedestrians in unsignalized crosswalks.
Be nice. Be legal. Be safe.
Brought to you as a public service by the Cambridge Bicycle Committee and this station.
Good evening, Boston, Cambridge, whoever may be listening. You are listening to Hidden Gems in Plain Sight. Proving you it's not that hard to find good music if you know where to look. And I'm trying to show you where to look right here on WMBR 88.1 FM, Cambridge, MIT's public radio station. Happy summer, everybody. If you didn't realize it before, it is definitely for sure now that it is summer. It is great out. I'm your host, Josh. We're just trying to show you a bit more music in the new rock area than you would usually get off of regular radio stations. And I don't know about you, but you know, a lot of stuff hasn't been great lately, you know, in general. But I don't know, I've just been feeling good lately. Like, you know, summer's up, you know, there's a lot more sun. Feeling good. So, you know, usually while most of the music you'll listen on here is like a lot of different emotions, especially indie, is usually somewhat like melancholy, angsty, cynical. Feeling like today's a happy day, and the entire first half of the show is all going to be really, really happy music, like just ecstatic. These first guys, I think I've told you about them before, they played here at MIT just a couple months ago by the name of Harlem Shakes. They got a bad review on Pitchfork, which I'm not a big fan of in the first place. They gave them like a 5 out of 10 because they said they were too happy. There wasn't even a hint of cynicism to their music. It was just this like unrealistically optimistic sound. Sounding music, and I'm like, well.